This is Through the Rearview, a podcast from Three Aspens Media. I'm your host, Lindsay Young. On this show, we look back with the leaders, innovators, and storytellers who have helped shape their industries. We unpack the lessons they've learned, the pivots they've made, and the legacies they've built. It's a chance to reflect, reconnect, and get a view of what really matters. In this season, we're focused on the wholesale distribution industry. Enjoy. Today's guest is someone I've had the privilege of knowing and learning from for more than 20 years, or nearly 20 years rather. Mike Marks is a legend not only in his own mind, but also in the distribution industry. Known not only for his deep expertise, but also for his no-nonsense practical approach to solving big challenges. He co-founded Indian River Consulting Group, or IRCG, back in 1987, after a couple of decades in distribution management. Since then, he's built a consulting practice that's laser-focused on B2B channel-driven markets, and he's earned the trust of executive teams across virtually every vertical. If you've been in this industry for a while, chances are you've read something that Mike has written, you've seen him speak at an event, or maybe even worked with him directly. He's one of the most insightful, candid voices in the business, and I'm excited to have him on the show today. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Lindsay. Did my mother write that introduction?
So I'm going to make your head bigger before we begin.
Well, I'm not wearing a hat, so we'll be okay.
Okay, great. So let's kick this off where you started, because, you know, while a lot of people in the distribution industry associate you very strongly with this specific market, this isn't where you started. So can you give us kind of an introduction,
where
you got started? Yeah.
Well, when I was doing my undergraduate work at San Fernando Valley State College, which is now Cal State Northridge, I had a job working for Litton Data Systems as a timekeeper. I go around and make sure the engineers are filling out their time cards. Well, for some reason, I guess some people liked me, and I ended up getting pulled into and employed by the systems engineering department, which also had all the proposal work done. And we developed, this is back in the first worlds of digital, this is late 60s, early 70s, and digital was changing everything. And so we were basically Litton Data Systems. We made weapon systems for the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and basically all of them. And so the problem we were having is that the engineers were really smart. They'd put these great proposals together, but the people that were deciding to award the contracts couldn't understand what they were saying. So they chose me to be the canary in the gold mine. And they stuck me into systems engineering, business development. And so every time we were doing a proposal for the U.S. government, I sat in all the meetings. They got me this super security clearance and all this stuff. And if Mikey didn't understand it, they had to go back and rewrite it, which pissed off a number of the engineers. But we actually, it turned out I actually had a flair. Now that I'm older and know, I had a flair for process and understanding process. But at the time, they called it a flair for systems engineering. So I was involved with what's now become SOSIS and AWACS and TACFIRE and Sigma and a bunch of other things. So anyway, I mean, all that's expired. That's all ancient history, but that's basically where I started.
Did you learn a lot of things you wish you hadn't learned?
Knowledge never hurts you. No, knowledge will always make you better. You just have to know how to handle it.
Fair enough. So obviously that's now everybody knows that, you know, from the start, you've always been someone who cuts through the BS, so to speak, and says things how they are. So you just told us how that job came about, but what's the secret? You know, is this just something that you were born with, or do you have any tips you can provide on making that kind of complexity clear, cutting through that corporate jargonese or the technical?
It's really all just about being a genuine person and showing up as a human. And people you see so much corporate speak today that people can't even understand what it is. I did a class at the university talking about how do you interpret a quarterly earnings discussion where a CEO in a public company is talking to the market and all the code words they use back and forth, which if you don't know what's going on, it's all just advanced BS. But you know, to me, you just have to be genuine. And I mean, I was raised that way. And the reason I ended up in that deal with systems engineering back in the day was because I could actually be respectful, because my parents taught me that, and point out that, you know, more in sorrow than in anger, I just don't understand. And well, I am a closet nerd, and I love data, and anyway, I say shit a lot for people so that they think I'm a sales and marketing guy, but I'm a closet nerd.
Well, I like to say, Mike, that if you wouldn't, one, speak like that in real life to a friend, or how would you explain it to your mom, for example? Is that how you would explain it to your mom?
Exactly. When we're actually doing work with companies and they're talking about policy, I said, you have to pass the spouse test. And they say, what does that mean? I mean, that somebody doesn't know all your three-letter acronyms and all this craziness. You have to show it to your spouse, and they have to understand and be able to explain it back to you. And if it doesn't pass the spouse test, you've got too much bullshit in it.
Absolutely. So your first exposure to sales and B2B was as a manufacturer's rep. Am I right about that?
That is correct.
And you were given the dreaded rest of the world territory. So how did you, approach that challenge?
I need to frame it. From behind me, I'm a car guy. And so I was a manufacturer's rep of racing products for Indy and race cars and drag racing and road racing and all this other stuff. So I loved all of that. And I had a car back then that had 500 horsepower, which would be like having 1,200 horsepower today with inflation. So I loved the job, got involved in it, but the ROW territories, all the good salespeople gave up all their crappy accounts and they gave them to me. And, you know, so you had 300 customers and a total backlog of $1,000 a month, and 'cause it was all crap. And Jack Goldstein, my very first mentor, I'm successful because I've had the blind luck of having mentor after mentor. Mentors provoke excellence in you. I really didn't like him at the time, but I did learn a lot. And so Jack said, Mike, this is a great territory, and you're lucky there's new market research out. And I said, what's that, Jack? And he go, a new Yellow Pages, here it is.
Oh.
And I go, Jack, is there any training for this? Now, you got to remember, this is back in the 70s. And he said, no, Mike, it's before the world's politically correct. He said, Mike, this is field sales. You either got it or you don't, be a man. And that was it. That was my onboarding process. So anyway, I just went out and tried to sell. And I'd never sold anything before in my life. Fortunately, I'd started off with very high self-esteem, or as you say, a legend in my own mind. And so I just charged out and ran into a number of walls.
But you figured it out.
You did figure it out, you know, and I did the old school. You got to remember this, because I'd doing all this on my own nickel. I went to Dale Carnegie, right? Figured that, you know, that's the only training thing I could find back in the 70s. I kept calling on customers until their will to resist melted down and they gave up. And I actually had a customer say, if I gave you an order, would you go away? And I said, how big? And that kind of summarized my entire career as a manufacturer's rep.
So what's one lesson then about selling industrial products that still holds true today, no matter, I mean, you're not using the Yellow Pages anymore, right?
No.
So what's one lesson that still holds true no matter, you know, how things have changed?
B2B is very different than B2C. And the main difference is the consequences of system failure. Uh-huh. If you order a new thing, a perfume or dog food on Amazon, it doesn't show up, nobody's going to die. Right? In B2B, as soon as you don't deliver on something, it's a crisis for somebody else. And so if you start looking at B2B, the thing that's so different is that trust between individuals, between a salesman and a buyer, in two businesses, it's a proxy for supply chain reliability, because that customer knows that they're important enough to me that I'm going to move heaven and earth to make sure that I meet their expectations. And getting that trust as an individual, now you can lose it with one lie, but you have to earn that trust the hard way. And once they see, that is the proxy for the supply chain reliability. And before, I mean, fundamentally, field sales is... There are only three things that are uniquely American. It's field sales, jazz, and baseball. Everything else we stole from somebody else. And when you really think about it, The salespeople go out on their own trying to do something, but they have to earn that. Once they earn that trust, a customer will call you up and go, what's the story? What do I need to do? And they'll listen to what you say because you've earned it. And that, frankly, I think it's even more important today because there's just so much crap out there and digital noise and craziness. And it's just, when you find somebody you can count on, those relationships matter a lot. And one of the challenges with young people, where they're doing everything virtually and working from home and the rest of it, they rarely get it. It's much, I don't say rarely, it's wrong word. It's challenging for them to build those trusting relationships. And one of the things I learned from Dirk van Dongen back when he was running NAW, I said, Dirk, how did you end up having lunch on Tuesdays in the Oval Office with sandwiches? And he smiled at me and he said, Mike, you know, all I've done my whole life is I collect relationships and I share them with my friends. And that kind of burned, I never burned a relationship. My very first, when I was a corporate officer at Ducommun, right, and I was doing corporate training, and I had every customer that was $100,000 a year or more that went to zero, because I was really good at suck-up behavior. But, what the point is, we were obviously a good solution partner. We screwed up. They got mad. So typically, we had the solution still work. You just basically had to unscrew it and put it all back together. So completely forgot what your question was, but that was a very exciting time. I got it.
Oh, go ahead.
So I was high enough in the company that I got invited to resign. I got into a sort of a urinary distance contest with the new CFO. And I thought all these people that I'd been buying these training materials from, I thought everybody's my friends, and all these people ghosted me. They were just fair weather friends because I spent money with them. And so ever since then, when there's somebody I worked with and they ended up losing a job or the company got acquired, they got whatever the reason, I still to this day will reach out, what can I do to help? Because it really irritated me beyond all belief. It was kind of, I felt like a betrayal, but that only happens once. But and what's really interesting, it goes back to what Dirk said about, you know, acquiring relationships and sharing them with my friends, because we've had a couple $1 million clients that showed up 2 years later. A guy called up, you're the only one that talked to me, you're the only one that told me the truth. Even when the customer had one person call up and said, I know we didn't hire you, we hired somebody that told us what we wanted to hear, but you were right. And there's a lot of good karma in that. So that all those things are still true in business today, and they're actually even more important, I think, because it's so hard to get that level of trust.
Absolutely. Yes, you've always been a friend to a lot of people in this industry, including myself.
They've been friends to me, too.
Mike, you mentioned mentors earlier in this conversation, and the number of recognizable names in the list of your mentors is pretty impressive. So you've had the privilege of meeting or working with some of, you know, the top minds in leadership. So we're talking about Michael Porter, Peter Drucker, and others that you've mentioned.
Chuck Adizes, it's a long list. And it's blind luck. I tell people I'm like Forrest Gump, but I can't run. And, you know, if you want to get better at something, right, in racing, I either win or I learn. You need to play against a better opponent so you actually learn. And so just hanging out with those people, just some of the droppings of their intellect helped. Peter Drucker taught me how to ask questions. And basically now that I'm semi-retired, quote unquote, although other people laugh at me because they say you're semi-retired, it's what other people call
retired, full-time. Yeah.
Full-time. But sitting on boards, some of the biggest impact I have as an outside board member is everybody's in the middle of fighting, what are we going to do? We're going to go left or right now, all these issues and emotions and data-free opinions held with a lot of conviction. And then you just sit there and let it go for a while, and then you ask a question, and the whole room goes quiet, and nobody's ever thought about it, and they're all kind of like an intellectual vapor lock, and then the conversation changes. So there was actually a class in graduate school when I went to Claremont, and Peter Drucker was my faculty advisor, and he didn't do that, and he also gave us intellectual property rights to his material to teach it in China. And so we had an office in Beijing for just almost 9 years. And Bob Swing, one of the founders of the company, was over there running it, married his Chinese translator. There's a whole dinner conversation in terms of all those things. But what happened is he actually had a class that we took called Work. And it was, you're going to think I'm nuts, but he said, everybody talks about management and everybody talks about all these organizational big things. Very few people talk about what is work and how do you get it done? What's the difference between good work and bad work? Is the work happening fast enough? It was a fascinating class. And a big part of this is learning how to ask questions. So that was a great deal. The other thing is I teach global strategy every November in Upper Austria at the University of Applied Sciences, their sister school with Florida Tech. And one of the things that to me people ignore about Michael Porter is he talks about competitive intensity and he talks about competitive advantage. But when he talks about the five forces, competitive intensity is like one of them. And everybody always assumes that, well, I'm in the one with the highest competitive intent. They have no idea what it really means. And then also, how do you do judo to reduce that competitive intensity, which links back to creating competitive advantage? And everybody, they learn this stuff in school, they memorize the terms, but they never learn how to use the model and do the critical thinking to apply it to an actual problem. I teach critical thinking at the university, and because my parents taught me that, and it's been hammered into my life my whole time. So it's and if you think about second order thinking, it's all about building a list of questions, right? And when I'm sitting, and I just did one a couple of weeks ago with some PhD candidates, and I gave them a problem after I talked about second order thinking and first principles thinking and inversion, and, you know, the basic, just like I took four of the basic models. And they immediately go in and start solving the problem. I said, no, second order thinking is about what are the questions? What is the question? Going back to the old Paul Harvey, what's the question behind the question? And can you restate that as a question? And it was really fun because once they start to do it, you can see the lights click off and everything works for them. But the thing with competitive intensity, every one of Porter's five forces requires, if you're going to apply it to a business, it takes a lot of critical thinking. There was a gal, I think she worked for McKinsey, but at one point in her life, she wrote a book called Michael Porter for Dummies. And it actually dumbs it down so most people get it if they take the time to do the critical thinking. So
I'll have to check that out. Mike, do you think people are afraid of asking questions? Especially if you're not already at the top of the, you know, pecking order or organization.
That's never occurred to me.
And you
got me thinking now, because I'm one of those guys that always led with my chin in a bar fight. You know, I was hanging out with some retired Navy SEALs, and none of us were in any condition to operate a motor vehicle, We're just talking about lives and where people peaked, and did you peak in Vietnam, or did you peak at the King and Queen of the Prom, or whatever? And then Norm Carly said, Mike, you peaked in third grade. And I go, well, what are you talking about? And he goes, you like to figure things out and share them with your friends. That's the perfect background to be a consultant. We'd like to do bad things and not get caught, you know, and seared into my brain. So, but in terms of asking questions, I invariably start with questions, just I always have, and I've never been afraid, although I have, and I've never insulted anybody, but I've described them accurately, and sometimes people call that being rude or inappropriate, but I just ask questions. So the idea that somebody would be afraid, if young people are afraid to ask questions, they're never going to get anywhere. Because there's so much misinformation and BS in the official policy. Look at a human resources handbook or a manual, and the people put the motivation posters up all around, and it's a crappy place to work, right? But they all, you get paid and promoted for looking good instead of doing good.
Well, I also am one of those people who's never, ever, ever been afraid of asking questions, because that probably led me to the path I'm on, which is journalism. And now we interview people, write content. You can't be afraid to ask a question. But the other piece that pops to mind, though, the piece of advice that I give to people about that, about asking questions and not being afraid to speak up if you want clarification or if something doesn't seem quite right or you want more details about why they think that way. I think people are afraid. Some people are afraid to ask questions because they don't want to sound stupid. They think everybody else in the room understands something. But in many cases, you speak up and you ask an easy question, and everyone else is like, oh, yeah. And everybody leans in to listen. And you learn that some people are keeping a mask on, you know, pretending they know everything that's going on. But if you ask the question, everything becomes a lot clearer, which means you can make better decisions and you can have a better conversation and all the things. But that's been my experience with that. And I just think that...
That parallels mine, and it does. But the information is always part of the solution. And just a lot of people, it's kind of like the airlines measure on-time departure when they close the door at the gate, right? And so there's me and along with probably 100,000 other people have spent the night in Atlanta, right? If you're in Florida, if you die, you can't go to heaven. You got to go through Atlanta first on Delta. But I'm standing at the window looking out. They're loading the luggage for 10 minutes, but they won't open it because it lowers their customer service rating. And I'm just come out make 5 million miles this year on Delta. They don't care. But people grab data that's easy to measure and it's not important, but they hang on to it and then they really screw up what it is they were trying to do in the first place. That I love data. Data is your friend, and you have to ask questions. The more questions you ask, the better answer you're gonna get.
Yeah, you have to understand what the story is around and behind the data.
Yeah.
Otherwise the use of it gets very skewed. I'm just as passionate clearly about this as you are. Because information is frequently...
Well, I read your blogs on how to write, and I'm glad that you've fixed most of my passive writing.
A lot of people write passively. It's okay. That's what editors like us are for. So I guess moving on to the next question. Let's jump to when you started Indian River Consulting Group. Talk about how that evolved from, I know it started with executive search and it evolved to the sales strategy and channel consulting firm it is today. And you've helped a lot of distributors and a lot of manufacturers in this market. So how did you get from there to here?
When LexService bought Schweber, I became their business development guy. My job was it was an English company, right? I'm commuting back and forth. My boss was on the board of British Airways, so I got to fly the Concorde and it was all cool. I was a legend in my own mind, you know, and I'm buying all these companies, and I'm convinced I'm, you know, a captain of industry, but back in the 80s, doing leveraged buyouts, an untrained monkey could have done it, but I mean, I didn't know any of that at the time, but so I was buying companies in the States, and I freaked out, and I was in London, woke up in the middle of the night in a panic, adrenaline surge, I think it was a mini nervous breakdown. Knowing I was late for a meeting and I was smoking at the time, took two cigarettes before I realized it's an end table. There's probably a phone book. I realized I was in London, said, I got to get out of this godforsaken place. And so I had they'd taken very good care of me with a nice golden parachute and all that kind of stuff. And so I decided to reconcile with my second ex-wife that we'd gone through a nice amicable financial planner. And she'd moved to Florida, set it all up to be by her mom. I decided to reconcile with the second ex-wife. And so I quit, and my plan was to go back and finish my PhD, and I was going to get a tweed jacket with the leather patches, and I was going to get a pipe and teach at FIT and purvey wisdom. It was going to be wonderful. Well, I get back to Florida, and 11 days later, she goes out to buy a gun to shoot me, so I call the police, and they said, get to a safe location and call us back. It ended up, long story short, made the newspapers twice. I ended up with sole custody of a 6-year-old girl, 9-year-old boy, and a restraining order against her. Went through a personal bankruptcy. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible mess. I ended up, I had to go get a job. I had to do something. And so when I was buying companies, there's an old thing that once you've been a king, it's very hard to be a prince. And so a lot of times you buy a company and you got to take out the big guy. And we called it, were very English, and we said we made them manager without portfolio. We put them in an office with no phone, just before email, and they could just sit there or go home. We'd still pay them, but go away.
Yeah.
And Roger Gabriel, who was one of the founders of Paul Ray, one of the big search firms that said, I think they're part of Heinrich and Struggles now, but Roger was working in Century City and frustrated with the almost a two-hour commute each way. He knew Melbourne. He'd lived here for a couple of years, so we hung up a shingle. And Roger was, that was a search connection. And so we were either going to call it Roger and Mike's Excellent Consulting Company. You can think about the movies at the time in 87.
Yes.
Or we could see a picture of the Indian River looking out the corner of the bathroom window. And so it became Indian River Consulting Group. So we had to do that. And so then we have two guys and we're just starting. We got nothing. His wife was our bookkeeper and we took all of our receipts and put them in a green trash can and gave them to our accountant once. It was really primitive.
Yeah.
But the thing that put us on the map was I was also on the board of the National Electronic Distributor Association when I was at Lex. And we had a week-long program for our executives to go to Texas A&M. And they were having, Texas A&M was having problems with the sales and marketing. Where they had speakers, they were too academic, didn't get the distributor thing right. And so Nita said, well, why don't you get Mike? And so I went down there and basically that was, I knew how to do that part. Being a nerd, I already had a bunch of models and stuff. So what happened is I started with NIDA, and then it was ASA, and then it was NHREW, which is now Hardy. I mean, and so all these trade associations would come in, and I'd be doing I'd do a day on sales and marketing, and I'd be down there for 5 days, and they just juggle it, and all these people kept coming through. And then the people that were there would bring me into their convention for either a workshop or a keynote. And in 1999, I did 99 speaking engagements. And swore so I'd never do it again. But yeah. Because of that, all of a sudden, everybody knows something about Indian River. And what typically happened, I would do a workshop, and it, you know, I'm very direct, and
yes.
and no bullshit, and so people can kind of see it. And I always I did my lectures like I teach. It's more graduate level, so it's very participative. So you're always asking. So you asked me original about the teaching. The best way to learn something is to have to teach it. And every time I taught a class, every time I talked to people asking them questions, I would learn more about it. And the group that put that original program together, UID, was with the AEA, Association Executive Alliance.
Alliance.
And it was like a dozen trade associations, and they said, we need to do something just for distributors. So we had, it was probably 3/4 practitioner and 1/4 academics, but they were sharp academics, and we had basically the whole Texas A&M mafia and Don Rice and Mike Workman and Stephen Pierce and Bill. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it was everybody for everything. It's just an inch wide and a mile deep on industrial distribution. And they've gone through several things, and the program's changed a lot. It's moved away a lot from the traditional distribution where people can get a basic boot camp on what a distribution all about. And it's gotten much more into the soft skills now and everything, but it's a different generation. But that AEA leadership has kind of kept this thing up, and we still change. I would say we probably change 15% of our speakers every year based on the evaluations. So anyway, what I try to do, like in the critical thinking, I actually show them the prompts that I use on large language models to design a 4 1-hour courses on teaching critical thinking. And I showed them the prompt and showed them how to do it and said, why don't you, now that you've learned how to do second order thinking, and they all got excited about it once they figured it out, this is neat. And I said, why don't you go teach it in your company? What do you mean? I guarantee if you teach it, you're gonna learn a lot.
But
the thing is, if you're really focused on the students, and that means what the student needs sometime has nothing to do with what's in your lesson plan at all, right? But you do what's right for the student. And so I don't care if they criticize you that you didn't do all your slides, because there's a bunch of people in the room, they all wanted to go this left, and so you go that way, right? This is executive ed. It's not curriculum based. So anyway, I think that they've done a really great job of keeping it alive, and it's going to continue to grow and develop. But teaching something is, number one, you learn it, and number two, I became a better race car driver when I became a licensed instructor teaching people how to drive race cars.
Yeah, I don't think I knew that you taught people how to race or do race cars, race cars. That's the
worst. That's where I got the shirt. You know, you go down, take a bunch of, you know, doing McLaren.
Very
I'm
cool.
A licensed instructor for Ferrari and Porsche and a bunch of others. And you, when you buy one in Florida, depending on how much they get in your pocket, they give you 1 or 2 days on a racetrack, you know, at Daytona or Sebring. But they got to have somebody like me that's got the license that can sit in the passenger seat going, break, break, we're going to die in a ball of fire. So
I'm definitely not well suited for that path. You would hate me if I was sitting next to you at a race car.
When I took Marilyn to the racetrack and let her drive my Porsche, I took a friend of mine to let him instruct her because I knew if I tried to do it, it would be really, really bad for me.
Yeah. You guys might not talk for several days, probably. So two things emerged from what you just said for me. The first was you're talking about learning from teaching. 100% agree. I think also learning by writing about things is also a thing, right? There's zero chance I would know what I know now about the distribution industry if I hadn't written hundreds and hundreds of articles.
Exactly.
And interviewed and talked to so many great minds in this industry. So I think hopefully that doesn't get lost, but I encourage people to both do what you said, teach, and do what I do, write.
And I read at least 1 hour a day, no matter what.
Yeah.
And you got to read and learn, and there's just more stuff you get, and try and write, and then you fix it for me, and I shouldn't be exposing all this in my interview. But
that's
yes.
Okay. That's okay. It's still your brain. We're just helping you put it down on paper. The other thing that sticks out to me is you and everybody else that I've interviewed for this podcast so far, and you're just number five, so it's been five so far. Every single one of them, there's this trend or this consistency.
A theme between us?
A theme, thank you. There's a theme between amongst all of you where you all have pretty much been very willing to say yes to opportunities, even if you weren't 100% prepared or ready or even qualified. For those opportunities. You said yes, and then you jumped in and you figured it out, and you were probably more qualified than you give yourself credit for. But a lot of what you described was you saying yes to those opportunities to work with those different associations and to teach on different topics and to work with different companies. And I just think that's a really good lesson for anyone that's up and coming in this industry, to say yes and try new things.
I'm probably one of the older guys on your interview list, so I've raised the average age of your interview candidates, and I probably lowered the average IQ. But the thing is, when you get older, what people regret are the opportunities they didn't take. And one of the things that happened when I was running Schwebber, we did a value clarification exercise, brought in a psychologist, and you know, you get a little stickers on value. And put it down, and I discovered, and it has been driving my whole life, I didn't know until I put the sticker down, I've always wanted to have an exciting life. You know, I get bored really easily, and so I need to, you know, if I have time in my calendar, there's nothing going on, I'll add something. It's technically called being event greedy, right? I just fill it all up. And I mean, my friends are that way. I mean, met a guy for dinner. He showed up 30 minutes late and he held up his iPhone and said, I'm sorry, I had to cram an hour's worth of meditation in 15 minutes. It's really tough, you know. But the thing is, you get all this energy and you want to do things and you're learning things. And you, like I said, my light, Norm was right. My light did peak in third grade at show and tell. And I just like to figure things out because I got this terminal curiosity. I break things because I'm playing with them and trying to figure it out. But everybody that you had, it's about, and if you think about opportunities, a new opportunity, it can be something that's not an opportunity to other people that have done it, but a lot of these opportunities are things that nobody's done before, especially with this modern day of AI and digital and all of the industry change. So what constitutes qualified when nobody's ever done it before?
Sure.
Right? I'm jumping in the deep end of the pool. You know what's really cool? I didn't have to wear a weight belt this time. It's going to be a lot more fun. you know? So,
yes.
But you just fail fast, learn from it, and keep moving on.
Yeah, I agree. So speaking of AI, Mike, today you're working on AI projects with a lot of companies. And you also worked with AI, we didn't talk about this yet, back in the day as part of, you know, a contract. You kind of mentioned it, but you've been, basically, you've come full circle, right? Can you tell me more about the AI work that you're doing today, and maybe based on that experience, how you see AI reshaping the way companies are thinking about strategy and training?
AI has been around since the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The first AI language was Lisp. I was a beta test site on Prolog. I did an AI project for the U.S. Army back in 1970, and it was basically just a lot of math and Monte Carlo simulation, and I had some adjustable arrays that were Lisp cases. All Lisp was, if all these knobs are this way, you should do X. If the knob changes, do Y. I'm oversimplifying it. But,
sure.
But you could actually load data into the arrays, you know, in changing situations, and the Monte Carlo simulation. It's still classified, I think. I don't know. I went to the Freedom of Information because I wanted to talk about it, since I'm doing all these AI things and I'm in all these AI forums. I'm actually, I teach prompt engineering at the university, and I actually had just taught most recently at the last UID course in terms of how the things go together, and I'm very involved in orchestration, which is kind of the, nobody's really talking about it yet, they're just talking, but there's, I have a hypothesis that anybody that thinks they're an AI expert knows 6% of the field.
Probably.
94% they don't know. And I came up in the algorithms and all that stuff. I've learned and spent a lot of time on the training of some of these large language models, or at least when you're trying to custom, like you want to bring an open source Llama in and you want to get a sales coach for your salespeople. So we've done a lot of this stuff with training and how to do all that. But I've got probably 15 newsletters on AI that I get, and people that I talk to, and I don't know any, I'm not even trying to keep up with all these other crazy things. And there's so much misinformation and so much bullshit, it's unbelievable. You know, they talk about FOMO, fear of missing out. And when OpenAI came out with O3, which is their first reasoning model, they were bragging about one of the astronauts in the International Space Station took a piece of paper, wrote a diagram on a thermodynamics problem they were having with condensation. They took the picture and uploaded the JPEG into O3. And not only did it recognize the picture, it told them to figure out how to solve this problem. It interpreted it. It gave a solution that they were able to implement, and it worked. Right? So everybody's going, ooh, wow, gee whiz, golly, cool. Guess what? O3 can't win at tic-tac-toe even when it starts. And there's a thing called the jagged edge of intellect in all of AI. And when you think about it, in isolated cases, they can all do brilliant things, but they can also absolutely incapable of doing a lot of other things. They cannot come up with a world view to predict orbital mechanics of anything. They can come up with it, but it's totally full of that. So don't get me going. I could kill the rest of your interview.
Very passionate.
But there's so much misinformation, and there's so many huge use cases out, you know, and there's some really bright people out doing some things on them. But it's just what I've come to now is that from the time a distributor stops thinking about it and they actually say, damn it, we're going to go do something, until they actually have something that's in production. They've got a use case that's on the ground, and it's not new. Everybody's just using it and going, hey, this is cool. It's about 12 months.
Uh-huh.
So and so everybody's waiting to see what everybody else is doing, and they're looking, well, I'm waiting for some software package to pop. I was just at the DSG AI summit that we had here last month, and Ian and Jonathan had managed to get 41 suppliers of software that had specific distribution solutions on a couple pieces. It's, none of them are platforms, right? You got the ERP guys, you know, they're all working on it, and everybody's kind of going their own way. Some of them have some real model challenges, but that's a different discussion. But all these things are there, and a bunch of the companies that had shown up there, what you do is you find out, where do we suck the most? I mean, if you just want to think about it, it's Eli Goldratt's constraint theory, right? If I could change one thing that would make my customer experience better, reduce the heartburn and butt rash of my sales team, make us more money, what is that one thing? That's the critical constraint. And when you look at the research, and McKinsey's doing some really neat stuff here, and 75% of their view of what distribution is going to get out of AI is all around customer experience and process flow internal to the company, 75% of it. And the thing is, once somebody gets over that first hump with that 12 months, the next one can happen in a couple weeks or a couple months, and the thing gets faster. So there's going to be a catch-up problem, because MDM just published a survey about distributors, what they're doing with AI on 3Is, three-year study they've been doing, and it basically just came out this morning. The larger companies are engaging much faster than the smaller companies, and the thing that's really interesting, it's not a cost issue. It's executive leadership and vision, and I think a lot of these owner-operators, I took it over from my dad, and I never went, you know, everybody's waiting to see what everybody else is going to do before they do it, but once they start, they've got that 12-month cycle. You just can't fly by. I mean, look at how screwed CRM implementations have been. And this is much more about organizational change management than it is about technology. Sorry, you got me all excited.
That's okay. That's okay. I have a lot of questions swimming through my mind. But one of them is, if I can spin off that a little bit, you mentioned the 41 vendors that were DSG's Applied AI, where I was there too.
I know. We had a drink.
Yes, we had a
only
drink.
Only one, because they were rationing it. It was terrible.
Actually, I found my name tag from that the other day. A bunch of people gave me all their extra tickets, so I'll just hold on to
those. Your mother warned you about those people when you were a teenage girl. Don't take drinks from strangers.
Take drinks from strangers. Thank you, Mike, for that advice. Not a concern anymore, thankfully. Is when you're a distributor and you're... Okay, this is just my opinion, and this is me going off, but there's, and just as a whatever, like we work with some software companies that have, you know, that, so we're writing a lot about AI and AI power and all of that. But when you're a distributor and you're looking at these platforms and you're thinking, I need to adopt AI, which sounds like such a generic, broad statement, like what the heck does that even mean, right? It seems to me like there's more options now than there were 2 years ago to actually define that and identify opportunities. But everyone claims to be AI powered and AI driven and AI platform. So how does one actually sift through all of that noise, knowing that we're 2 or 3 years into this kind of AI craze now, to actually get down to, I guess, nuts and bolts and do something about it? And filter the noise from the real.
Everything is AI enabled now. All somebody has to say it's AI enabled, and it's just like, as a golly gee whiz, it's like everybody wanted a hula hoop. It's the same thing, and they haven't changed the software. It's like when the cloud first started, and all the ERP guys and everybody else started saying we're cloud enabled. All they were is they were able to put their system in the cloud and run it remotely. Right?
Absolutely.
Right? But they didn't have any of the capabilities that the cloud provides. It was still just an on-premise system. It was just sitting remotely, which is stupid. And everybody hypes it out. So if you're a distributor, the very first place I would point you to is DSG, MDM, your own trade association. There are a lot of people that are out there. And I know several of them are your clients. Am I not supposed to mention people?
You can mention people.
Well,
sure.
But I mean, Brooks Hamilton and Tony, well, Nick Pericles kind of leading that. And I mean, there's a number of people out there that are doing really, really good work here. But if you go look to your association, they're filtering a lot of this, and the people they're putting in front of you get you the straight scoop. The only way you're going to deal with this is to have your own bullshit filter. And it's like anything else. Everybody wants to make it. It's all artsy-fartsy, super intergalactic. It, you know, leaps tall buildings in a single bound. Just when you sit down and talk about how it actually works, it ain't that tricky. It really isn't that tricky.
Yeah.
So they need to get it. But the thing is, the problem, you know, when I talked to Nick and Brooks, one of the things they're doing, they're taking people on these AI journeys where they get a bunch of their managers together, which I think are wonderful. But mm-hmm. part of the problem is that they can't, they can explain the whole AI thing and all the hooks and how you put it in. But a lot of times the managers come in and they don't even have enough background to recognize that they have a process problem or they have a structure problem. And so they come in and they need, you would think it'd be just really fundamental stuff that everybody know. But they don't, and they, the key thing, I think a lot of these guys are starting to, I know Nick's talking about it, is actually having somebody go through some kind of an audit process and come up with a couple of use cases, and uh-huh. then what they'll do is they'll take you on the journey and hold your hand and say, look, let's apply it specifically to this, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we went through, we used to do digital roadmaps for people about what you needed to do, and the first thing you find out, are you ahead or behind your customers? If you're behind your customers, you fix that first. And if you're not behind your customers, you start applying it inside to take friction and everything else out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you take, think order entry. We did this for a building material distributor. And they had basically, think about inside sales or order entry or whatever you want to call them, that the orders would all, typically it's all fax and email. And then it's the rip it off the fax. It's called rip and re-enter, and they type it in. And the only error you'll never catch until it's delivered is an error in order entry, because everybody else does exactly what they entered, right? And so all this manual labor, they reduced those positions by 40% as soon as they put basic order management. And digital order management, there are several companies that were there, and frankly, I was a little challenged by them because they talked about how great and brilliant they were, that they could do automatic order entry, and it can, you know, we can take it from somebody dictating it in a voicemail or a fax or doing anything else, and the only thing they don't have are smoke signals yet. But they talk about, this is great, we're going to be wonderful. It's a commodity. There's so many people that can do it well now. Why uh-huh. are you doing it this way? Because you've always done it. Well, I don't know how to change. I'm duct taped to the wall. That's the challenge they have. It's easy to change. You put the solution in, you figure out how you do it, you manage the transition with a little reserve just to make sure you don't put one foot on top of the other. So when you discharge a weapon, you get both feet with one round. But I mean, it's just work. I mean, and they get paralyzed about creating change, right? I mean, I got a salesperson, I don't like them, and they've been there for 35 years, and we want to get rid of old Herbie, and so they don't want to do any performance stuff, but they'll go out and buy Herbie a carton of Camels every week and hope for the best. You know, I mean, you need to be a little more decisive. So, but that's the lifestyle owner-operator issue. So
yes,
sorry.
And we could probably talk for an hour on that topic.
Yes, we could.
Okay. Totally shifting gears just a little bit, because I just think this is a really cool thing that you're doing right now. It's not that you are mentoring Gen Z, you're getting mentored by Gen Z. So you flipped the script, right? You have invited students locally from the local college to work with you so you can learn from them. So any surprises or lessons that you learned from that so far?
Quite a few. I'm in the board of Florida Tech and the board of advisors in the College of Business. I'm also in charge of the curriculum committee, and we're trying to different discussion. So what happens every school year, our graduate faculty gives me their three best MBA students. They come to my house once a month. I give them each a $100 bill because graduate students never have any money. The very first meeting, they're always very nice to me because I'm old and I have very little hair left. And, you know, they're nice. They're nice to grandfather, basically, is what it is. And I say, if we're going to do this, we're not going to continue. Because I give advice to companies, right? And everybody talks about, you know, we had these stereotypes of these snowflakes, and they don't want to do anything, and everybody wants to be president in 2 years, and nobody wants to work, and blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on and on. And so I say, I want to know what you guys look for. I want to know, when you hear about your peers, what you like, don't like, and what's going to make you leave a job. If you go to work for a job, what do you expect? What do you think they're going to treat you like? What's going to make you leave? And then once we get this going, actually, this goes back 3 years. This is the very first year I did it. It was on YouTube, and they played a song on, you know, open up the phone, hit the button, right? They're all digital natives. And they played this song on YouTube celebrating the death of the last baby boomer. And I was laughing so hard I almost peed in my pants. It turns out that when the last baby boomer died in this song, that apparently the unicorns have been around all the time, and all the unicorns came back, and they're glowing and all rainbowy as soon as the last baby boomer died, and the whole world just got wonderful. And then I decided this would be perfect to use at one of these executive workshops in a trade association, but YouTube took it down for inappropriate content. So
that's clever.
So when I figured I'm what they're talking about being dead, and I thought it was hysterical. So anyway. But the things they care about, and I will admit that there is a single-digit percentage of snowflakes that you say anything critical to them, they just melt in the ground. And mm-hmm. And I'm convinced the number one cause of that are what I call helicopter mothers. And I've actually had students we have to create resume-worthy experiences. When they get to be seniors, we do mock interviews with them. You know, I'm going to play a Wells Fargo hire, and you're going to come in and interview for a regional. And I let them go until they blow it, which is usually about 10 minutes, and then call time and give them some advice. I had a kid say, I have a real interview. And I said, well, that's great. Where are you going to go? And he tells me, and he goes, can I take my mom? And I go, what? And I go, can I take my mom? He said, no, they're hiring you, not your mom. You show up there with your mother, I guarantee you they will not hire you. And by the way, this is not an isolated problem. And I started to, so this kid is all wrapped around the finger. Mother's telling him exactly. It turned out she was sitting outside the interview room. She wasn't even supposed to be on campus to make sure everything went okay for him. So I started to tell him, because at the time, my daughter was a West Point graduate. She was on her first combat tour in Iraq. Ended up doing two for she, well, you know her. So he said, and I talked to him about, you graduated with honors, got a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. You could go directly into Officers Candidate School. You could pick whatever MOS you wanted. They'll pay for your graduate school. And he got all excited. He said, would you talk to my mom about that? And I said, I'd be happy to. And so she comes in, and Sheldon said, Mike wants to talk to you about a career in the military. And she snaps up and she says, only criminals and stupid people go in the military.
Oh, no, that's awful.
Well, I immediately remembered the old line, never approach a horse from behind, a bull from the front, or an idiot from any direction. I said, I'm sure you're right. I wish you well. I didn't say what I thought after that.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
But I don't even remember what that question was. I'm still pissed off at that. And these helicopter moms are ruining these kids. Kids need to go to school. They have to have challenging ideas. They have to have stress with new ideas. They have to try things and fail. They have to develop self-independence and rely. And the single-digit percentage, there's no hope for them. I mean, it's sad.
It's going to be hard, yeah.
But when we talk about the 90-plus percent, they've got great values. They want to work. They have no tolerance for working for Triassic reptiles, or what they call PMS, pale male and stale executives. Uh-huh. And what happened, that they want to work somewhere that they're working for a company that's ethical, that's adding value to society and is proud of it and is clear about how they're adding value. They want to be able to make the world a better place. They want, and they come into a company that doesn't do digital, and they got some green screen inventory control for inside sales, that nobody wants to be associated with somebody like that because they know it's a dead man walking.
Yeah.
And their values in terms of how they get things done, I've seen some absolutely amazing things that they can get done. You know, NASA has, our university started because of NASA. We have these competitions with NASA in science, and these kids kick butt. They just kick. They're brilliant. We win these hackathons. They just don't want to work for these old school that, well, I want you to be loyal, right? And kiss my ring. Don't get my finger wet. And it's just, you're so privileged that I gave you a job. And they just don't get it. This whole power and positional power thing, they're just not going to work. And so, to me, they have the perfect set of background and experience for the way the world's completely coming apart.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a lot of the social bound, a lot of the structure that we had for civilized societies fundamentally broken and is breaking more and more rapidly. And so a lot of these traditional businesses won't exist anymore. You know, everybody talks about AI eliminating jobs. I think AI is going to eliminate businesses. I mean, if you look at Brad Jacobs and what he's doing in the building material business, I mean, one of the things, and I made enough money on his other stuff that I bought myself a nice motor yacht. But I mean, he's also a no bullshit guy. But his whole point is that we have gotten so used to having shitty service. I mean, this is Mike's translation. He's much more professional. But, you know, the customer orders something from us and I order 15 and we tell them when it's going to get there and maybe it won't get there or maybe part of it will get there or we'll end up substituting something else and not tell them. And the customers have gotten so used to crappy service and everybody mentions, compares themselves to everybody else and they all suck the same amount. And everybody's got, I stayed married to a mean woman for 11 years. You get used to anything. And so what's happened, Brad's saying, look, when you order from us, we won't take the order. If you want 15 and we only have 14, we'll tell you. You have a choice. We're not going to tell you that and ship you 14. And you know what's going to happen? People like that are going to change the world. You know, they think about, if you think about customer experience, what Brad's talking about, he's talking about customer experience the way they asked Jeff Bezos back in early 2000s and one of the, I listened to those deals. And they go, well, what do you think about competition? This is back when they'd gotten out of books and they were just going to get biggest, early 90s. And he says, we think about competition like Boeing thinks about gravity.
Ah.
It's just there. I don't pay attention to it. We play our own game. We do what we can for our customers. And Amazon is a sourcing organization. It's not a sales organization. Jeff said, we help people buy. That's all we do. And I can be sitting in some, I was sitting in Busan, Korea, in my jockey shorts at 2 o'clock in the morning because the time zone, I couldn't do anything. And I'm buying stuff on Amazon for my kids, you know? So it's just sourcing. So when you start thinking about that, and you go back to just what Brad Jacobs is doing, he's going to dramatically change. And it's not just bigger. Everybody think bigger in scale, right? Look at what AD does, affiliated distributors.
Yeah.
These are independent. It's a very large organization taken as a whole, but there's a whole bunch of them that are owner, operator, managed, but they're professionally managed. Okay? Their growth rate is significantly faster than the giant public company change because Drucker talked all the time about there's a right size for a business. And you can derive it analytically and you take a look at it, and bigger isn't better. Bigger is just more bureaucratic. And so that's part of the problem with AI. The big guys, because they can spray some money at it, it's the small people. It's all about change management, moving quickly, and the small guys are going to disrupt all this. And this is a long way around, that if I'm a Gen Z, and I have that, and I'm digital native, and I understand all these things, and by the way, you come in as a freshman, you won't get out of your first year of business school without knowing Python.
Hmm.
Right, and Python is programming for dummies. I mean, it's. I'm even taking a course in it now because I'm doing a bunch of stuff with AI, and they're generating Python language. I need to get the ecosystem. So, but
that's,
I mean,
awesome.
You know, everybody figures that out as you go, and the young people, they're going to fix what the baby boomers screwed up. I'm embarrassed to be a baby boomer, because if you go back to what a grandfather's supposed to do is, back in the days of the Romans, I'm supposed to be out planting the trees because I know I'll be dead, but I want my grandchildren to have the pleasure of shade. Yeah. And I'm doing things for the next generations. And that's, everything had been that way up until the baby boomers, because the baby boomers are all about me, 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 me. Enough of me talking about me. What do you think about me? And it's, what can you do for me? And they're sucking everything out of it they can. And the next generation coming through is going to fix it. I feel very comfortable about that.
That makes me feel good. We have a few more questions left.
Sure.
I want to ask, you know, we've covered a lot of ground so far. Looking back, What do you hope people will take away from your body of work? Because you've done a lot of teaching, a lot of consulting, this podcast, of course, a lot of speaking. What do you hope people will take away from all of that? It's a tough question, I know.
Go jump in to do something. Stop trying to set your goal that I want to be president of a company, or I want to get a bunch of money, or I want to do, there's something. It's that you're going to make for a miserable life. Find something you care about, that you actually care about, and you have to study. And it's not about entertainment. It's something you care about as a cause or people, and then go jump in with both feet and go do that. And what happens, if you think about wealth, the way you create wealth is that I add value to society, but I also have to have money to get the things I need. When I add value, I get money. If I add value faster than I'm consuming it, I create wealth. It's as simple as that. And what kids don't know is I get a raise, I go out and buy a BMW. I mean, I get a raise, I need to put that money. I'm going to create wealth because my money is working for me, not just me. It's not an inflationary lifestyle. And so if you jump in and find something you care about, and they say it takes 10,000 hours to become an expert at something. And an expert has failed more times than the beginners ever tried, right? Mm-hmm. So find something that you really like. You know, in the Orient, if you spend any time in Asia, what people do is they have an avocation. I'm a Japanese gardener. My back may be gone, and I may not do much of it anymore, but I'll be a gardener for the rest of my life because I'm proud, and that's my avocation, and I keep studying, and I keep learning. And you want to do something, and if you really want to get to be a senior executive, it's not about being smart. It's about being an absolutely brilliant communicator so that you can help other people understand what we're trying to do and where we're going and doing all these things. And to do that, you need to get a whole career of development jobs. Somebody's putting you in to do something, you're learning it, and you do a whole bunch of learning jobs before you get a payback job. When you get the payback job, there's no learning curve that bringing you in because you've got the skills and the ability to create shareholder value or whatever you're doing. It could be an NGO or not-for-profit or something. But what they should learn is chase their passion. I've been in distribution for 50 years, and Peter Drucker always talked about, I'm the professional observer. And he had a huge impact on me back then. And I have been an observer for 50 years about how distribution has changed and continues to change. And change is a good thing. I mean, at some point, you know, I'll be dead, everybody else will be dead. The distribution is still gonna be here. I mean, we're like cockroaches, we're impossible to get rid of, you know. Well, understand, a distributor can lose money till cows come home. Distributors only die when they run out of cash.
Yeah.
You know, and you can run out of cash just as fast by growing really rapidly and not doing it. I mean, that's what happened to Unisource in the beginning, you know, when they went through bankruptcy and all these other things. And that story repeats itself all the time. So find something that they care about and do something that you love. If you do something you love and you can actually make a living at it, you're going to be a happy person. Well, from my point of view, I use this story a lot. I say we all end up dead. And Lindsay, I hope it's decades in your future.
I hope so.
And you're in a prone position, surrounded by many grandchildren and loving friends. And they wonder, why does Lindsay have this little grin on her face as she leaves the world? And you're thinking, man, what a ride.
Yeah.
That's the only way you win. Because people, at this age, I'm going to more funerals than I am weddings. And you go talk to people that are in hospice or somebody that's sort of towards the end, they always regret what they didn't do. Now, I have a long series of really stupid things that I've done, and I still continue to generate those things where you're saying it seemed like a good idea at the time. Uh-huh. I'm better now than I was 50 years ago, but it's just a gene. It's a bad gene, bad boy gene, I guess, or a stupid gene. But the thing is, you're at least doing things, you're living. You look yourself in the mirror and you think, you know what? I lost that battle. And a lot of times it makes, here's the advice I would give somebody coming in. And I'm gonna read it to you because it hit me a hardcore Stoic, as you know, and I've been that way for a long time. And I'm holding up this picture, and I will read it to the audience. And thinking of life as an iterative game changes how you play. Positioning yourself for the future carries much more weight than winning in the moment. You can win all the battles and still lose the war. And if you keep thinking, this is what I have passion about, this is what I care about, this is what I'm good at, I have some skill at it, and I want to do it, I want to keep learning, I want to be a lifelong learner and learn more. And so all I care about, I either win or I learn. And taking that feedback from people, right? You know, that whole thing, feedback's the most wonderful gift in the world and nobody knows how to open it and they get all defensive. But the one thing that has really helped me a lot is just, and I've been criticized for changing my mind too often, but I keep getting new information. If I get new information, that's why I never use the words always or never, because I'll never be wiser today than I will be tomorrow.
If only more people had that perspective, Mike.
Well, then I'd lose some of my differential competitive advantage, which allows me to race cars, have a really great girlfriend, have two wonderful grandkids, two kids that are both doing really well. And I'm just a happy guy. You kind of get old and drifty, you know, wearing glasses. I got hearing aids, you know, I'm doing all these supplements now. And it's just, all right. Betty Davis said, getting old ain't for sissies.
No.
But I still have a national competition license and can compete effectively.
That's awesome. I don't see you slowing down too much yet, Mike. So you might be traveling less, but you're still keeping busy. You're still doing things. So,
are we through the questions? Are there more questions, Lindsay?
There are more questions. Sorry.
Of course there's more questions.
Well, there's two more, because I think you answered the first one of the ending questions already, the advice. The next two are ones that we're asking of everyone. So I'm posing them to you too. And I know we've probably covered this too, but I just want to kind of bring it up to the surface. One thing about the old school way of doing business you think still holds value today.
When you think about old school and new school, are you an excellent communicator? Can you get things done? Do you have the right kind of values that people want to be with you and be associated with you? That includes the integrity and all the rest of it that goes along with it. And that whole thing, can you engender and create trust in relationships where people say, when I'm in trouble, I'm going to call you because I trust you and I know you'll tell me the straight answer even if I don't like it. Mm-hmm. That is, as long as we're humans. Now, people get lost in this AI thing because we're very close. So it depends who you talk to. But we've created a new kind of intelligence and everybody's calling it AI because they don't know what to do with it. But if you start thinking about it, we have organic neural networks and we've just created digital neural networks. And so we're really prejudiced for different people of different races, and we had slaves and everything else, and we're looking at AI the exact same way. And they're just another form of intelligence. How many different forms of intelligent life are there? And what is the definition of life? And people aren't dealing with any of this yet. So to me, I think there's a lot of upside to just be curious and keep learning. And old school and new, if you read and look every day, what can I learn today? When I go to bed at night, I think about what did I learn today that I didn't know yesterday. I thank God for the day. I'm looking up at the sky, whatever's up there, and I'd sure like another one if I get one. But what did I learn today that I didn't know yesterday? And I just don't feel good if I don't have an answer. And over 76 years, that adds up.
Knowledge based on your experience and. What do you think? This is the last question, Mike.
You're teasing me, Lindsay. Go for it.
This is the last question, I swear. But based on your knowledge and experience, what do you think should excite the next generation of leaders?
I think their opportunity is phenomenal because I think the fear that everybody, all this FOMO stuff everybody's talking about, and you talk about the breakdown, we've gone from global trade and we're going back to spheres of influence, which is another whole discussion. We've now power, people are leveraging power against those people that don't have power. right? You start to take a look at all this stuff. This is going to, the acceleration, the breakdown's going to accelerate, right? And you know, you, and by the way, you're not going to have three spheres of influence. It's just like, if you talk about organizational behavior, the duopolies are stable, but a menage a trois is not. And so if you look at Putin, you look at Xi Jinping, and you look at Trump, you know, there's one, two will always align against one. I mean, it's happened since the beginning of time. So we're going to see all this change, which is going to disrupt all the old people like me, right? And the millennials and the, you know. But the thing is, a new generation coming through, it, every crisis creates more opportunity. And people are going to come up with new solutions so that we don't have to stock all this inventory. There have been isolated things that most of them never get to see the light of day. But if you go back and look at Motorola semiconductor, and then you look at Selectron, which is one of the largest global manufacturers, contract manufacturers in the world, they make electronics for people. Well, one of the things that we did, and this is all, well, Motorola put the inventory on consignment at their distributor.
Yeah.
So Motorola still had title, right? But the distributor had it. It wasn't on their balance sheet. It was on Motorola's balance sheet. This is very important. Avnet sold to Selectron. They put the inventory at Selectron on consignment. All right, so now the cost, if you talk about the working capital in the channel, that somebody's got to pay the cost of the interest costs and the working capital, the cost is at Motorola's manufacturer cost, not with a markup and a markup. Right, so that lowers it. And Avnet, how did Avnet get paid? We knew, because of this Semiconductor Industry Association, we knew what the average selling price of TTL Logic was to the three significant digits, right? And so anytime they could sell product and raise the ASP, the average selling price, they got a big commission. They got a little commission, basically a transaction fee almost, for sales at ASP, and it dropped to pretty much zero if it was below ASP. And then so all of a sudden, you take all this inventory on the channel. It's called enterprise consulting. If you put all three of these companies together, right? We used to do some of that. I'm retired now. But we did a deal with some large medical device manufacturers that wanted to eliminate one of the giant distributors. So we take all their data. And we said, if you can set up your own distribution centers, can you do it and get rid of them? They couldn't even come close to getting rid of the giant distributor. So, but my point is, there's all kinds of things that people can do and innovate. We don't have to do it this way. We did it this way because it was the only way we could do it. And distribution started in the U.S. in scale right after World War II. Uh-huh. Because everybody came back from the war and couldn't get a job. And old man Gordon got eggs from a farmer and went door to door and sold them and went back and got more eggs. And that's how Gordon Food Service, right, up in Michigan. So, I mean, there's all these stories that are in there, but anyway, I think the young people are going to benefit from this chaos and misery, and they're going to bring hope back to the world, and I'm waiting for the unicorns to show up when I leave.
I'm excited to see those, too. I'm not excited for you to leave, just to clarify,
I'm hard to kill. I am very hard to kill. There have been, I have three lives left. I'm looking at myself as a cat. I held a boarding pass on a DC-10 American Airlines that left Chicago in 1978. The left engine fell off, and they didn't let me on the plane. I missed the flight. So, and the second ex-wife got it. It was all so. Anyway, just when it's your time, it's your time.
Well, that is quite the story to end on. Thank you, Mike, for joining me. As always, I learned a ton from you, and I thank you for all of the insights you've given me over the years, but thank you for sharing them with my network through this podcast. It's been awesome.
Are you willing to share your next victim on your podcast? Because I know the guys you had. I mean, I like hanging out with those guys. They're all pretty, you didn't get a dummy yet, but.
I haven't gotten a dummy yet. I'm pretty picky about the dummy thing.
So they got one yet? Next one?
I do have another victim, so to speak. I'm getting something lined up with George Patti.
I love George Patti.
Yes. So I'm really
I spend
excited
most of
about
my
that.
time with George Petit. Tell him Mike said hi, and that I'll look forward to seeing him in the next bar I'm hanging out in, because that's it. Well,
awesome.
Thanks a lot, Lindsay. I really enjoyed it. God knows
Thank
what, how you're going to edit it, but you're on your own.
I have a lot of experience editing you, Mike, so I think we'll be just fine.